made angry sounds because I guess their backs had started to hurt. I'll be damned. Are we done here? I snapped. If I was going to find Big Blue alive, I needed to move. Technically. And that means you have immunity. He agreed, reluctantly. But we don't have to let you into the scene. I'm on the Senate's task force for smuggling. I'm trying to help shut them down. Sure, but we still don't have to let you in. I released Huey and Louie, who showed their appreciation by cursing at me. I was gratified to notice a big red mark across their faces, where skin had met door. It didn't look like I'd broken anything, though. Pity. What do you want? I asked James. I already told you. Information. What you know for what we know. I don't know much, but you might. I thought about it. I might. Pooling our information could be useful, couldn't it? We don't need any help from the damned. Huey's outburst cut off abruptly, although James hadn't even moved. I blinked. It was impressive, in a Darth Vader-y kind of way. We're both on the same side, James told me smoothly. I looked at his boys, who might not be talking but were breathing like a couple of bulls in winter. Sure, same side. But I still needed to get in there. Okay. I stuck out a hand. James took it. He smiled brilliantly. See? Was that so hard? Finn and I exchanged a glance. Freaking war mages. There were more mages inside, but nobody else smiled at me, or at Finn, who was ambling along at my side like a 3-foot Watson to my diminutive Holmes, one with wild tufts of hair sticking up from the ride over, which made him look like a crazy-haired troll doll, to the point that I saw a war mage do a double-take while I looked around for Big Blue, or parts thereof. I didn't find any, and it wasn't like I could have missed him, and not only because of his size, but because the mages had done more than turn on the lights. The warehouse was a relic from an earlier age, slowly moldering to pieces on the waterfront. It had probably been empty before the slavers found it, because pieces of the roof were missing, and weeds were growing up between some of the floorboards. But the smugglers had done enough to make it usable, which mainly involved installing some cheap hanging fluorescence. It was still gloomy, the size swallowing the dim glow from overhead, but in places, it was downright dazzling. Footprints and handprints gleamed on walls and floors like angels had left them, sparkling with a bright white gold fire. The marks the slavers had made when they hit down had left smears and splatters that blazed a brilliant scarlet against the dark. And a pile of crates by the wall, large and perilous-looking, had a rainbow of different colors spilling out from gaps in the wood as if screaming, "Look here!" A reveal spell, then, and a good one. It had even brightened moldy graffiti back to readability, and left ghostly imprints of long-rotted advertising posters glowing against the bricks, and there was a sizable crew in place to take advantage of it. War mages were guarding entrances, medical staff were examining bodies, and what I guessed were forensic types were crawling all over everything, muttering spells at suspicious items. One of the latter had just made a glowing footprint float up into the air and rotate like it was 3D, and then actually become 3D when it suddenly flew off and attached itself to the shoe of a guy being loaded onto a stretcher. Immediately, a whole line of bright footprints, including some near us, suddenly went dark. Having now been identified, I realized. Okay, take 'em, the mage said, and the body was carted out, one shoe still glowing. Another mage was busy summoning a trail of blood off a support beam, causing the drops to separate from the peeling paint and fly into the air, and then to shimmer and change, from crimson to gold, and from tiny to huge, before turning into a mass of gleaming strands that whipped about wildly in space, like the tentacles of a crazed octopus. until, with a final flash, they coalesced into the shape of a man. It looked like a life-sized hologram of a mummy, its missing body outlined by threads of floating magic. They glimmered golden bright against the darkened room, which was visible through gaps between the filaments. The whole was strangely beautiful, like an artist had carved a statue out of light. But the features were liquid and shifting, impossible to read, and the body itself was generic, with no identifying flaws that I could see. It was an impressive display, but other than approximating the guy's height, I wasn't sure what the point was. I'd seen more useful police sketches.
"Got a weird one," the mage called to James, who stopped abruptly. "How weird?"
He didn't get an answer, but the next second, the light man became a light wolf, huge and silently snarling out of a fang-filled mouth. I reached reflexively for a knife. It was that real, and heard Finn yelp something profane from behind me. The mage, however, didn't so much as flinch.
"Must have gotten away," he said, standing calmly next to his hologram horror and checking a computerized notepad. "None of the bodies are Weirs. Run 'em through the system. Find out if we've met 'em before."
The mage nodded. "Through the system?" I asked, still staring at the wolf, which was snapping and lunging in place because he never moved from the mage's side. But still, a furious, oversized, golden wolf giving every impression that he wants to eat you draws the eye.
"Yeah." James looked at me. "Why?"
"You think a shifter was slaving shifters?" He shrugged.
"Why not? The Fae traffic Fae."
"But not the same kind." He shook his head.
"The first thing I learned in this job, some people will do anything if the money's right."
"Yeah, but..." I broke off, ducking low as something soared overhead, barely missing us. Finn cursed. James just stood there, and I stared upward at the creature hovering near the ruined rafters. It was a phantom version of the Eagle Boy, I realized, and just as he'd been when, at a guess, he was injured in the fight and spilled a little blood, which meant partially transformed, with a human body but huge feathered wings. They were currently shedding sparks that flew off through the air, or pattered down onto the floor, lighting up the old boards and turning the warehouse's collection of ghetto diamonds, broken bottles and scattered glass, into what looked like the real thing. In the golden glow of the spell, he looked like a medieval depiction of an angel, a spectral, otherworldly figure floating midair, and making the lofty warehouse appear momentarily cathedral-like.
"Like a Botticelli come to life, isn't it?" James commented, looking upward. "Or a Fra Filippo Lippi."
He wasn't wrong. But a nearby mage didn't seem to agree. He was standing there with a frown on his face, watching the great golden wings beat the air, maybe because the Corps now knew that the boy had been here but didn't know which side he was on. I guess even magic has its limitations. "He was one of the prisoners," I said. "I saw him on the feed." That didn't get an acknowledgement, but the mage noted something on his pad.
"I want that tape," James told Finn, who nodded, his eyes still on the spectacle above us.
Guess he hadn't seen that trick before either.
Neither had I, because I'd never gotten this far into a circle crime scene.
I guess rank did have a few privileges, I thought, as another mage called out to James. He went striding off, his coat billowing up dramatically behind him.
"Think they put a spell on it to make it do that?" Finn muttered.
I just shook my head, too busy gazing around at all the other activity to come up with a rejoinder.
The warehouse was like a working anthill. Just in the area around us, a woman, clairvoyant at a guess, was holding a guy's wallet and looking pained. A white-coated medic was directing a line of levitating stretchers toward a heap of bodies, and a war mage was building a tiny, perfect replica of the warehouse out of light. It was an exact copy, including even a clueless-looking little Finn and me, standing in the midst of all the activity, getting in everybody's way. At least, that's what I felt like. Someone out of her element who wasn't helping, and who couldn't have, even if she had wanted to, because none of this was remotely in my skill set. But then I noticed something that was. Over by the door, dim and quiet and unnoticed, were the Selkies I'd seen on the feed at Finn's. They were still in seal form and still piled up together. I didn't know why. They had plenty of room to spread out now. I also didn't know why they hadn't just left with the others. The open door, hanging half off its track, was only a little way behind them. And beyond that, across a few yards of dock, was the ocean, littered with light on the surface, but deep and dark and mysterious below. It would certainly give them an advantage over any pursuing mages. But they hadn't moved. Maybe too weak? It made me wonder why the smugglers didn't take better care of their cargo. Why go to all the trouble to bring in Fay and then not feed them? And, for that matter, why bring in Selkies at all? What the hell were they supposed to do? Kill with cuteness?
I bet they ain't even talked to 'em, Finn muttered. That's why we have all these problems. Nobody talks to each other. They don't know nothing about the other guy. They just assume he's bad 'cause he's different. And if they meet one who ain't, well, he's got to be the exception, right? When we're just people.
He broke off, scowling. Can you talk to them? I asked. He frowned some more.
Maybe. Depends where they're from. Fairies like Earth. We got a lot of languages.
But you could try. It looks like they've been here a while. They might know...
Gah!
Finn cut me off, suddenly running in front of me and waving his arms.
What the hell? Did you see it? It almost took my head off.
I looked around, but didn't see anything, except for glowing holograms and startled-looking war mages, until something that was definitely not a hologram came zooming right at my face. Chapter 35. I ducked, spun, and pulled a knife, and slashed at something that looked like a cannonball, what little I could see of it, because it was zooming around like a crazed drone, until one of my strikes connected, sending it careening off into space, where it was promptly turned into a fireball by a nearby mage.
What the hell? Finn squeaked.
Not again, James said in disgust, as a few bits of charred metal and a clouded lens clattered to the floor.
Several war mages went striding out the door, looking pissed.
Check the roof,
James called after them.
That's where they were last time.
I walked over to where he was glaring at the remains. The best I could tell, considering the state of the thing, it had looked like a smallish black soccer ball, with lenses fitted around the sides, one of which appeared to still be operational, because it focused on James like a curious cyclops, whirring to get him in focus, and blinked a few times, recording successively larger pics of the boot he brought down on top of it.
The damned press,
James said before I could ask, while further stomping the thing into the dust.
They've got their panties in a twist, thinking we're concealing some great underworld war, when from what you tell me it's just an escaped slave on a spree.
He looked at me again.
Unless there's anything else I should know.
Not about him. I hesitated, suddenly wondering if this was a good idea. The Circle's attitude toward illegals was well known, but so was their network and resources, and they'd been battling the smugglers far longer than the Senate. They could be a real help, if they wanted to.
But about something else?
James asked pointedly. A kid. A troll kid was at the fights 3 nights ago, I told him. You know, the same ones where your current problem cropped up? He nodded.
Ugly scene.
Slavers were killing the slaves to shut them up. We rescued some, but others...
He shook his head. Well, the kid was one you missed.
Dory,
relax. He died of his wounds. He's not one you'll have to find a portal for.
James scowled, but he didn't deny it. We all knew what happened.
What about him?
He said something right before he died. Three words. Fish, tracks, door.
I enunciated carefully.
Tell you anything?
No. You?
I shook my head. But there's a chance that on his deathbed, the kid wanted to give a clue about where he was brought in, or where other slaves were being held. But he was fresh out of ferry and didn't know any Earth languages.
So he went with things he saw.
I nodded. That's the idea. But he was dying, and probably fuzzy-brained, and he was a kid. They pick up on different things than an adult. But if we can figure it out, it may tell us who is still bringing people in. And where.
James scowled some more. It seemed to be the war mage resting face, but it looked weird on his usually pleasant features.
May tell you, he corrected. If the Senate wants to go ballistic on some slavers, that's their business. But it's not a priority for us.
I stared at him. Not a priority?
The guys upstairs consider it to be a problem that's solving itself. So why waste manpower on it?
It doesn't look like it's solving itself to me. He raised an eyebrow.
Doesn't it? Fights mean casualties. Sure, you try to make things look bloodier than they are and save your best people, but accidents happen. And even when nobody dies, they get injured and have to sit out for weeks or months. So you need a constant supply of new blood to stay operational. But with both us and the Senate on it lately, portals are getting shut down everywhere, and fights are getting harder to staff. Can't get people to come out for that.
He nodded at the Selkies. Rumor is, the slavers have started stealing from each other, I said, thinking of Olga's nephew.
But that just determines who ends up with the dwindling supply of new blood, he pointed out. It doesn't make more portals appear out of nothing. The big-time slavers, like the guy we raided three nights ago, are still in the game. Being powerful enough or well-connected enough to end up with the lion's share. But the little guy ends up with damned Selkies or nothing at all. It was putting them out of business.
Was?
More and more, the slavers are switching over to a new line of work.
I frowned. Like what? James didn't answer. He just gave a whistle that caused several of his boys to look up.
Toss me a crate. Which one?
James's lips twisted.
Does it matter?
One of the guys laughed, and then remembered that they had company and quickly scowled some more. But he put what I guess was a levitation charm on one of the crates by the wall and pushed it our way. It glided swiftly across the room, and James caught it, pushing it down to the floor, where it bobbed around gently. It was an old-fashioned wooden thing, with a few tufts of straw sticking out here and there, like it was having a bad hair day. It was also familiar, looking like the crates Dorina had seen stacked along the walls in that underwater room at Curly's. It was an odd coincidence, and for a moment I got excited. And then I opened it.
What a load of crap!
That was Finn, peering over my shoulder, but it looked like James agreed. The sad contents weren't likely to impress a guy whose dad owned a magic shop, one of the real ones. Instead of fake magic wands and marked decks of playing cards, it had an outer room stuffed with dried herbs, a counter stained by a thousand potions, and a back room where people exchanged power for cash. It was one of the spots around town where people whose bodies made too much magic, like war mages, for example, could go to get a little relief. Because magic had to be used,
A mage's body made a certain amount all the time, like a fleshy talisman, and if you didn't use it, bad things started to happen, and not just to you. Rufus, James' dad, had once told me about a mage who lit his own house on fire in his sleep. He let too much magic build up, didn't release enough of it, and it came out as a fire spell that torched his place and almost killed him and his entire family. And he wasn't the only one. Stories like that cropped up in newspapers from time to time, and were one reason magically talented kids were pushed toward the Corps, even if they didn't have the mental aptitude, like Huey and Louie over there. They were standing guard at the side door where we had come in case any nosy Norm showed up and needed to be pushed along their way. And they'll be doing that for the rest of their careers, never rising higher than the magical equivalent of beat patrol, because the brains didn't match the talent. But at least they wouldn't be setting themselves on fire. And they might make a little something on the side, selling their excess magic to Rufus or somebody like him. Or maybe more than a little. Some of the biggest juicers, as they were known, could survive just off selling magic. The amount needed for major spells was high, so there was always a market. I looked down at the crate. And then there was this. Nobody got paid for this. "Feel free to take what you like," James told me wryly, and then leaned over conspiratorially. "I'll cover for you."
Very funny.
I reached into the crate and pulled out one of the pathetic-looking orbs inside. The real things were perfect balls of shining silver that broke open to release a cloud of white smoke so thick and so dense it counted as its own patch of fog. The best ones could cover a block or more, allowing you to lose anything in it, including yourself. They were great for when a fight got too intense or backup arrived unexpectedly and you needed to peace out. I usually paid $500 a pop for one of these babies, which is why I never had any damned money. But I wouldn't be taking James up on his offer. I did squeeze it, sad, misshapen thing that it was, and watched the pale steam it contained filter weakly out the sides. I waited. James looked amused. Finn didn't look like anything because he'd wandered off somewhere. I spotted him over by the Selkies, frowning some more. Probably at their thinness, because to trolls that's practically the worst thing in the world. Knowing Finn, he'd be wanting to borrow my car to go get them Long John Silvers or something. Which, no, he couldn't see over the steering wheel. But I had no trouble seeing him, and the mages and the Selkies and everything else, because the orb had finally given its all, and its all sucked. "Are they all like that?" I asked James, who was sneering at the little thing the way a wine connoisseur looks at two-buck chuck. Which wasn't a bad analogy, because that's what these things were. The magical equivalent of Ripple.
"Pretty much." He batted some weak-ass fog away. "You've got your potion bombs barely stronger than human acid, your shield charms that might deflect a single spell, if you're lucky, your ward detection bracelets, which don't, your vamp detection bracelets, which also don't, although they did go nuts over my dog."
"Secret Weir?"
He snorted. "I wish. Then I could get the bastard a job. He's eating me out of house and home."
"You took these home? I thought you just found them."
"This batch, yeah. But we ran across another yesterday, in the last place your boy hit, and one a week ago in a warehouse raid. Looks like the guys with no portal access are branching out."
"Into this?" He nodded. "And it's selling? I couldn't imagine anybody spending good money on this crap."
"It's pretty general knowledge that we might have to fight the Fae," James said. "And people are freaking out. Plus, there's a crackdown on the legit stuff. The Circle's trying to keep the other side from cleaning out our dealers
and using our own weapons against us. Any big orders are flagged and held up until we verify the purchaser. It doesn't affect the guy on the street, just buying a few things to protect his family. But you know how people are. The directive caused a panic and sent prices skyrocketing. He cocked an eyebrow at me. Hope you're stocked up. Shit. So much for restocking on a budget. And with demand outstripping supply, even this stuff is selling like hotcakes, James continued, and getting ripped off.
Ripped off? People are stealing that?
He chuckled. You sound like the old man. He was outraged, too. But yeah, the batch from last night was traced to a truck robbery in Jersey City. We don't normally watch this sort of thing. It's not powerful enough to worry about, and the criminal element knows it. So they've started stealing what are basically gag gifts, repackaging them as legit weapons and selling them at a premium.
And nobody's noticed?
He shrugged. It's a new problem. Plus, most people aren't likely to use anything they buy. They just want some insurance.
So how good it is irrelevant.
Until they actually need it, and realize they've been had. False confidence can get somebody...
He broke off, because another flying camera had just zoomed in. This one was faster than the others, ducking and diving to elude the two war mages following it, and was doing a pretty good job.
Damn it! James barked. I told you to find them!
I think there's more than one group, sir. One of the mages panted, swiping at the flying menace and missing.
James said a word that sounded like an expletive, but I guess not, because the next second the camera zoomed right into his hand, as if magnetized. And a second after that, it was making these sad little whirring noises as it was slowly crushed in an iron grip. The parallels with Vader were just piling up tonight.
Then find both of them,
he snapped, and strode off, coat flaring.
James, look around, but stay out of people's way, he said, spinning and walking backward. And remember, we got a deal. What you know, I know.
He whirled and went outside, I guess to yell at his boy some more, and I stared back down at the box. Well, this was helpful. I poked around a little, hoping to find something useful, but it was difficult, because Finn was back, squatting down and getting his nose into everything. Literally. He was also looking a little weird, all of a sudden. His eyes were blown wide, for a troll's, but his mouth was almost non-existent. It looked like he'd been sucking on an alum lollipop.
He also kept casting little glances over his shoulder at a nearby mage, who was busy magicking up a model of a guy's face from an imprint in the dirt.
One of the slavers might have gotten away, but he'd left something behind. He had face-planted, whether from running too fast or from the troll's fist, into the couple inches of dirt that had collected by a support column. And now the mage was pulling out the imprint of his features and inverting it, leaving a perfect mask floating in the air. It reminded me of death masks I'd seen, the plaster casts of dead people's faces that were once considered a nifty idea. It even had a map of the guy's acne scars spread out over the thin cheeks and revealed that he had buck teeth. Although the latter might look a little different now, considering how hard he must have hit down. I watched the mage solidify it, muttering something that made the dirt harden into a clay-like model, and then wished I hadn't. Some of the features were mushed and flattened, on the side where he'd hit down first, I supposed. The solidification turned them into a sludge of misshapen earth that looked a lot like the faces on the mannequins, and sent a shiver up my spine. I looked back down at the junk in the box and wondered if this meant anything. I didn't like coincidences, but I couldn't see Geminis giving a damn about crap weapons. And for that matter, neither did I. I was looking for something big enough to warrant the response we'd had last night. Something game-changing. Something profitable enough to tempt a group of guys who'd just seen their family eviscerated to give it another go. This was not it. And then Finn grabbed my arm. The War Mage glanced over, his attention drawn by the sudden movement, and Finn started talking quickly.
"I used to carry this kind of stuff at my place," he told me. "They send guys around from the manufacturers, you know, with these display boxes. Pay you a percentage if you put 'em by the cash register or behind the bar. I made some nice extra cash for a while."
"You didn't feel a little guilty?" I asked, looking down at his hand, which was eating into my skin.
Nah, why would I? No different than that knockoff pepper spray they sell in convenience stores. Half of it don't work, but it makes people feel better to carry it around. More secure.
Without being, in fact, any more secure. If I was going to carry a weapon, I damned well wanted it to work. I also wanted him to let go, because I was about to have a permanent imprint of his fingers in my flesh. I tried shaking him off, but his grip tightened.
"And practical jokes," he said a little shrilly. "Most of the guys bought 'em for that or pranks. I made a killing."
"Then why'd you get rid of them?" I asked, as the War Mage started transferring his delicate sculpture into a case. It looked like they were finishing up, magic turning what should have been a day's work into a couple hours. The last bodies were being carted out, and cases were being snapped shut here and there. And somehow, I couldn't see James letting us stay behind on our own. Just as well, I had another errand to run. But Finn didn't seem to feel the same.
"Same reason most shops don't carry fireworks," he squeaked. "Some moron's gonna misuse 'em. Had a couple guys playing chicken with one of the acid bombs, and it ate a chunk out of the polyurethane on the bar. Had to get the whole thing redone."
"Listen, Finn."
"And then these two losers got in a fight," he said,
his voice reaching levels usually reserved for 12-year-old girls and dog whistles.
"And knocked the box over, sending all these things bouncing around the bar, some of 'em ricocheting off walls and breaking stuff, others setting fires. Weak don't mean dead, not when 50 of 'em get set off all at once. I had to shut down for the whole night."
The War Mage clicked his case closed and walked off, and Finn jerked on my arm, bringing me as close to his face as the nose would allow.
"We got trouble,"
he whispered.
"What kind?" "The big blue kind."
I looked at him and frowned, and then I looked where he deliberately wasn't, at the pile of selkies, all heaped up in one spot, even though there was no reason for them to be, and squirming, squirming, squirming. And hiding, 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 I realized, an additional couple people in the crowd. Well, shit. Chapter 36. I joined Finn in staring blankly at the crate and tried to think. Blue was massive, like, I've lived in smaller apartments massive, so he must be under the floor. No way were the Selkie's emaciated bodies concealing him and Granny any other way. But they could cover any light the reveal spell might have tried to shine up through the floorboards. Like, around a trap door? Seemed like the kind of thing smugglers might build if it hadn't been there already. Concealment charms worked better on enclosed areas, like a closet or a small room. Leaving them to float around nebulously tended to disperse them and use up power faster, and then your talisman putzed out or the spell became too thin to actually conceal anything. And why was I thinking about this right now? Maybe because I didn't want to think about how we were going to get them out.
"We gotta get gone,"
Finn said softly.
"They're gonna move those Selkies in a minute, and then
people die." Because no way was Blue going down easy. And no way were a bunch of armed-to-the-teeth war mages with macho meters set on overdrive going to play nice with an illegal, homicidal, massive battle troll and his gun-toting sidekick. This could be bad. Apparently Finn thought so too, because he started pulling on me.
Yeah, like us if we don't get out of here.
I looked at him. So that's your solution? We just leave him to be slaughtered or to slaughter somebody else? He nodded vigorously.
Now you're getting it.
He got up. I pulled him back down.
You could live with yourself?
Tiny, furious eyes met mine.
Better than I could as a greasy spot on the floor. I'm not a Domphere. You want to play hero, fine. Just don't expect me.
Pity about those prophets, though.
To be Rambo Jr., because I ain't.
He stopped.
What prophets?
The prophets you were rolling in tonight. The profits you're probably going to make every time those two take on some slavers. You've invented a whole new way to broadcast the fights, and only you have it. None of those other guys had your foresight.
Damn it, Dory!
And word is spreading. I could barely get in the door tonight. By tomorrow? Well, if there was going to be a tomorrow. But I guess not. The eye flaps of squintiness made a reappearance.
Don't think I don't know what you're doing. I know exactly what you're doing.
I just need you to drive a speedboat. Can you do that?
Sure, but...
There's one outside. I nodded at the lolling door, beyond which, tied up at the pier where the slavers had left it, was the boat they'd been planning to use for a getaway. Only Eagle Boy had kicked them off before they could, leaving it conveniently situated for us. Well, conveniently assuming we could reach it.
So I'm supposed to do what?
Finn whispered.
Load him onto the boat while surrounded by war mages? Seriously?
Yeah. He just looked at me. I'll provide a distraction.
Oh, great. Oh, yeah. That's what I need. A Domphere-led distraction.
Would you stop bitching? I said softly. Just get them on the boat. I'll take care of the rest.
Sure, fine, whatever. This is why I never go anywhere with you,
Finn informed me. But he slunk off in the direction of the Selkies while I looked around for a distraction. Huh, this could be a bit of a challenge. On the one hand, I was without my usual bag of tricks, which I'd been forced to leave in the car due to the sad lack of trust between us magical allies, and I was currently surrounded by war mages. On the other hand, distractions were kind of my thing. When you're typically the smallest badass in the room, you have to use whatever you can to keep the bigger ones from all piling on you at once, because they do that all the time. The movie bad guys who suddenly can't shoot straight when the hero is on screen, or who politely wait their turn to have a go at you, just don't exist in reality. I've never been in a well-mannered fight, or fought a gentleman warrior nobly giving me a chance to beat him. Well, not unless you counted Louis César. I stopped that train of thought abruptly, because it hurt. A stupid amount. It was also useless because there weren't any Louis Césars here. There weren't any guys like him anywhere. Stop it. So, options. Under the circumstances, there were really only two. The Tower of Treats in the form of all those crates, and Huey and Louie by the door. The crates would be more fun, and thanks to the trolls' rampage, there were plenty of things to send crashing into them. But there were a lot of them, and I didn't think the guys could possibly have gone through them all. They were probably going to cart them off and sort through them later, meaning they didn't know everything that was in there. And neither did I. And sending up a two-story mountain of magical weapons, however weak-ass they might be, wasn't a plan. So the boys it was. And since they were already looking at me malevolently, or as malevolently as they could manage past the now red and swollen stripes across their faces, this should be easy. And it probably would have been, except that another distraction flew through the door before I had the time to start. Actually, make that several. Okay, more than several, I thought, watching a whole stream of flying cameras charge in all at once. It looked like the reporters had decided that the only way to get a good look around was to come in force, so they had. And it might have worked, if they'd been dealing with anyone else. But war mages are a breed apart. And while their shoot-'em-up training is understandable for some of the challenges they face, where a split second of hesitation can get you dead, it can cause problems at other times. Like now, for instance. A fireball engulfed one of the little flying cameras, frying it mid-air, and a spell clipped another, sending it spiraling toward the ceiling, where it detonated in a burst of expensive parts. But there were a lot of little black balls left, maybe half a dozen. And, predictably, somebody focused too much on the targets whizzing around and too little on what was behind them.
No!
James ran back in, trying to corral his group of weapon-happy war mages.
Don't contaminate the scene! Don't contaminate!
Too late, I thought, watching a fireball miss a camera and hit the mountain of crates head-on. What looked like the 4th of July went off inside the warehouse's old walls. The mages promptly shielded. The Selkies fled through the open door, and I grabbed part of a pallet as a shield and ran for the side entrance. Because my work was done here. Or it would have been if I hadn't immediately gotten disoriented thanks to the thick white cloud suddenly boiling everywhere. There must have been a whole lot of fog bombs in those crates. And a bunch of stupefaction bombs as well, judging by the way I was suddenly staggering around. Not to mention incendiaries because something set my shield on fire. I dropped it and stumbled backward, awkwardly grabbing for another. But my head was spinning, my eyes were trying to cross, and I couldn't see anything but fog and the multicolored sparks lighting it in patches here and there. Or hear over the firework explosions of more crates going up, and some spell-enhanced war-mage shouts. And so my hands grabbed something else instead. Something that had been zooming by, and still was, only now it was zooming me along with it. Because whatever charm the reporters had put on their little camera balls, it was a strong one. At least enough to tow me through a couple war mages while I tried to get my confused head to tell my fingers to let go. And then into a support column. Ow! And then into thin air, as the determined flying camera I'd latched onto decided to kamikaze the ceiling, and the wall, and the floor again. After which it shot back into the air for no apparent reason, except to try to shake me off, I realized. Which was why I determinedly held on, even after all the knocking about had cleared my head. Because there was a reporter outside somewhere controlling this thing, and he was pissed that something was interfering with his attempt to get a scoop. If he couldn't shake me, the next step would be to recall his little device to sort out the problem, which would get me out the door. Assuming I lasted that long. Which might be a problem, because the fog covered a lot of sins. And Huey, or maybe Louie, I couldn't really tell them apart, was seizing the opportunity for some revenge. Only not with magic, because that leaves a trace, doesn't it? Unlike fists. At least, I guessed that was why one of them had just swung for my head instead of throwing a spell, and then grabbed onto my legs while I tried to kick him, probably assuming that I was too disoriented to fight back, since I was determinedly clinging to the little camera ball, which I smashed into his head a couple times, and then used my legs, which had bigger muscles anyway, to hurl him at a column. One he bounced off of and lunged for me again because, yeah, dumb as a rock. A rock that went barreling underneath me, because I picked my feet all the way up this time, to the point that I was hugging the camera. My ribs didn't enjoy it, but my eyes had fun watching him take out his partner, who'd been creeping up on the other side. They staggered off into the fog, and I deliberately wrapped my arms around the remaining intact lenses, wanting to end this. It almost ended me when the camera went crazy, bouncing along the ceiling before slamming back into the floor and dragging me across the rough old boards, and out into the night, because the mage had finally figured out that the only way to clear the obstruction was to pry me off. A guy came running up as the camera flew out the door. I let go and watched it shoot skyward when 110 pounds of Damphir suddenly went missing and detonate against the bottom of a helicopter because the regular cops had just arrived.
"What the hell do you think you're doing?"
The guy, the reporter, I guessed, yelled over the whoop, whoop, whoop of the copter's blades. He was a tall, thin dude with a shock of black hair and bright Asian eyes. Then he looked behind me and his mouth dropped open, and I didn't wait to find out why. I grabbed him and took a flying leap behind a cop car, where a couple of New York's finest were already hunkered down, staring as the warehouse all but exploded behind us with sound and fury and lots of sharp flying bits. The next seconds were a little confused. The guy I'd rescued started yelling at what I guess were more reporters, demanding to know if anybody had a camera that still worked. I got myself turned around to see that the building was still standing, sort of, but had crazy multicolored sparks shooting out everywhere, through areas of missing tile on the roof, spewing toward the heavens, through the open door, cascading over the broken sidewalk, and most spectacularly, at least from this angle, through the row of rectangular windows, which had shattered and were vomiting great tongues of fire at us, like the front of a dragon boat on Chinese New Year. The whole building looked like a huge Roman candle. I realized that maybe it would be a good idea to move back, because the sparks weren't just for show. They were spells, too, if very weak ones, but there were a lot of them, and they were raining down everywhere, including onto a passing garbage scow out on the water, which hadn't steered away fast enough, and was now a burning garbage scow, which would have been bad enough, but some levitation charms had been mixed in with the rest of the sparks, so the burning garbage was drifting up into the air and out over the water. Despite everything, I just watched it for a moment. The blue-black water and the flickering orange-red garbage and the shooting sparks illuminating all the graffiti-covered rocks by the waterside. It was strangely beautiful, in a Brooklyn sort of way. Unlike the huge piece of burning roofing headed straight toward us, I grabbed the reporter and took a leap into a ditch across the road.
"Who are you?"
he demanded, staring at me. And I have to give the guy credit, although for what I'm not exactly sure, because he yelled the question while the big jagged piece of metal bisected the cop car.
"Keep your head down," I told him,
while a frantic car alarm informed the fleeing patrolman that there might be a problem.
"Answer the question," he told me right back. "And you owe me for my camera."
I stared at him.
"Dick, I just saved your life."
He frowned.
"How did you know my name was Dick?"
"Just a guess," I snarled and started to crawl out.
"Wait."
He grabbed my arm.
"Where are you going?"
I shook him off.
"Out there. You stay here, unless your shields are way better than most civilians."
"So you're not a civilian?" He looked me over.
"You don't look like a war mage, and even less like a tech. They tend to be easygoing on the dress code, but not to that degree."
"Dick," I muttered, and he nodded and held out a hand.
"Kim."
"No, Dory."
"What?"
"Never mind." But apparently he did mind, and he'd used the ignored hand to grab my arm again.
"Richard Kim," he clarified. "And you're Dory. What, exactly?"
"None of your business."
"Ah, but it is my business. People need to know the truth."
"The truth is that you're going to die if you don't keep your fool head down," I said, as another piece of detonating warehouse screamed above us. It was really starting to go up now, which had me worried for Finn. Everybody else around here, including the cops in the copter, who had wisely gotten some air, was shielded or out of range. Even the techs the Corps used went through the same selection process as the tank squad, meaning that they could probably stand inside the building while it burned down and never feel a thing. I didn't have their shields, but I'd raced through battlefields tougher than this. I wasn't worried about me. I was worried about...
"Yes, yes,"
I grabbed the reporter and shook him while he stared confusedly around. I didn't care. I'd finally spotted the speedboat out on the water, well beyond the risk of the burning barge, and it even looked like they'd rescued Blue. I stopped, blinking.
What were they doing?
What are they doing? Dick asked, squinting alongside me. I had no idea. It looked like they were popping wheelies or whatever the nautical equivalent was. Blue's weight in back pulled the front of the boat up so much I wasn't sure Finn could see past it, which might explain why they were just going in circles. Big circles, over and over, while staring at the land but not the warehouse, which should have freaking drawn the eye. Unless they were looking for me. Shit! I felt around my pockets, but sure enough, no phone. I hadn't thought to take it out of the duffel before locking it in my trunk, in a car parked on the other side of the building. Shit, shit, shit!
Do you have a phone?
I asked Dick.
Why do you want it?
To call for pizza.
There's no reason to get sarcastic. It was a reasonable,
just give it to me.
He gave it to me.
You have fangs, he pointed out. Are you a vampire?
Want to find out?
He shut up. I called Finn's number.
What are you doing?
Waiting for you. What the hell?
No, don't wait.
What?
I have the car. I'll take the car.
What?
The wind was almost blowing his voice away and must have been doing equal damage to mine. Or maybe it was the half-dozen car alarms going off now, or the still-loud helicopter, or the continued explosions, because he couldn't hear me.
I said, I'll take the car.
Nah, we're not far. Are you in position?
Finn, just go. Now, now, now.
Now? All right, I'm coming.
No, not here. I didn't mean...
But sure enough, here they came, swinging about in a big parabola and then speeding this way. And fuck it, they were going to get caught. Or worse.
Stay here and keep down, I told the reporter.
Like hell, I'm coming with you.
I tried snarling in his face again, but I guess the first time had been more surprised than anything else, because he didn't scare easy, which had been more people's epitaphs than I could count. And how did I end up in these things? And then James grabbed the reporter and me simultaneously, dragging us out of the ditch and up to a face as thunderous as I'd ever seen it. Oh, thank God, someone to babysit. I broke his hold and danced backward, and the expression somehow got worse. Immunity, I reminded him, as the warehouse burned merrily behind us, as somebody with a bullhorn told us to drop our weapons, and as red and blue flashing lights announced the arrival of more cops. And as a speedboat laden with a troll doll, a hulk, and a tiny madwoman sped by on the water with everybody on board yelling at me.
Watch that one. He's trying to be a hero, I told James.
And then I took off, dodging through the chaos. Chapter 37 Mircea, Venice, 1458. The ship creaked and groaned, the old boards protesting the rough seas. It was raining again, with the skies as angry as the water. But this was a merchant ship, built to travel long journeys to distant ports. Mircea wasn't worried about sinking. It was almost the only thing he wasn't currently worried about. He couldn't see too well. His head had landed sideways, cheek to unshaven cheek with the not-so-animated corpse below him. It nonetheless allowed him to stare outward at pile after pile of baby vampires, stacked like cordwood all along the sides and middle of the ship's great hold. There were hundreds of them, their eyes closed, or open and staring blankly upward. Either way, insensate, unaware, and therefore unconcerned about the fate that awaited them. Unlike Mircea, whose mental gifts allowed him the dubious advantage of knowing exactly what was happening, but not having any way to stop it. He struggled against whatever power was holding him, but didn't manage to so much as wriggle a finger.
Merida.
The worst thing about this whole fiasco was that it was his own damned fault. He should have been more cautious. He should have expected a trap. And part of him had. He thought he had been so careful. Not careful enough. He'd picked up the strange angler with his human bait in the Rialto, the great marketplace of Venice, earlier that evening. It was one of the creature's favorite fishing spots, especially right after dusk. Mircea hated that time of day. Even though the darkness allowed him to be out and about, he really wasn't comfortable until the terrible sun had left to stalk another land entirely. But the angler was stronger than he, and always made an early start of it. So Mircea had to as well, and then had to find him in the crowded zoo the Rialto turned into after dark. Only the space-deprived Venetians would have put their abattoir, banking center, and marketplace all in one small area, leading to the sight of well-dressed men having to dodge flocks of goats, bawdy prostitutes trying to seduce wide-eyed farm boys, and clueless tourists having their pockets picked while they stared at Egyptian spices, Byzantine silks, Murano glass, exotic foodstuffs, and a crowd thick with Turks, Greeks, Spaniards, Slavs, Jews, and Moors. And that was just on land. The canal was busy, too, with everyone trying to pack up and leave at once before members of the city watch showed up to levy fines, or a swift kick, to merchants staying open past the evening bell. It was chaos, as usual, and as usual, Mircea found himself trying to avoid getting run over by a hefty woman chasing a live goose, or getting slapped in the face by the long sticks a boy had slung over his shoulder, strung with straw hats. All while trying to spot someone who was working very hard at not being seen. But then, there were other senses. Mircea slipped into the protection of a colonnade and closed his eyes. Immediately, he felt calmer, his mind filtering out the noise and bustle around him, piece by piece. First the animals, with their squawks, bleats, and coos. Then the people, talking, laughing, fighting, and bartering. And finally the incidentals, waves slapping the side of the canal, wind whistling across the rooftops, a stray dog pissing against a column, music from a nearby tavern, and the smell of newly lit torches, sweaty bodies, and the sea. Until there was only one thing left. They were slippery gleams on his mental horizon, cool against the human heat, still against the bustle. Vampires, coming out of their sanctuaries, peppering the square. Most of them were bright to his mental eye, like jagged bits of lightning glimpsed through churning dark clouds. He mentally excluded them as well. He wasn't looking for young and bright, but old and dim, someone who was hiding his true power, someone who didn't want to be found, someone like that. Mircea's eyes opened. The angler had cloaked himself in shadow, the vampire way of going dim and unnoticed, even while standing in the middle of a crowd. Or in this case, in the shadow of a portico, while his lure bobbed around the nearby market stalls, drifting idly among the vampires looking for their nightly supper. Not realizing that tonight, they were the prey. Mircea's focus was drawn to two babies who seemed to be hunting together. That wasn't unusual in most places, where baby vampires were part of a family and learned the tricks of the trade from their older siblings. But here, in Venice, most of the young vampires had no family, and were far too skittish to trust anyone. Here, they hunted alone. But perhaps these two had been brothers before the change, and were turned together. Or perhaps they had met on the perilous way to Venice's vaunted safety, and learned to trust. Or perhaps, like Mircea, they had some talent with the mind, which allowed them slightly more control than most their age. His speculation ended abruptly, when the trap snapped shut. The girl had walked between two market stalls, the vampires trailing close behind her. And when she walked out, she was alone. Mircea, who had been slouching against the side of the building, trying to look like he was waiting for someone, suddenly stood up straight. For weeks he had hunted the hunter, but had yet to answer one simple question. What was happening to